the fact that their child has been overreached in this particular way, but in effect that their own world has come to an abrupt end or certainly a change. The reactions to that by various parents, understandably, differ. Some people go through a very elaborate process of denial, either initially or sometimes gradually. And we have been aware in a number of cases of parents who finally convince themselves the incident did not occur, or that if it did occur, it somehow was the victim's fault, and they go to work on an already traumatized victim to try to get them to reduce their story. We have district attorneys who have come to us, to the juvenile court, and asked for intervention in a case to remove a child from the custody of just such a person as I've identified. There are some judges who will write such an order. There are other judges who will not. There is no case law on the subject, and my own view is there's nothing within the juvenile code which addresses it, unless you are willing to take advantage of very subjective information or language. 419.476, which is the jurisdictional section of the juvenile code, in addition to the typical ones people think about as law violations and so on, have a couple of definitions which may address this but may not, depending on who the judge is. Specifically, 419.476.1c says that a child is within the jurisdiction of the court whose behavior, condition, or circumstance are such as to endanger the welfare of the person or the welfare of others. But remember, this child's not in physical danger in my fact situation. It's an emotional war. So you might say, well, then how about subsection E, which is the garden variety dependency and neglect section? It says either the parents or any other person having custody of the person have abandoned, failed to provide with support for education, none of those, subjected the person to cruelty or depravity or to unexplained physical injury, or, and maybe this, failed to provide the person with the care, guidance, and protection necessary for the physical, mental, or emotional well-being of the person. One might argue that it's within the ambit of that language you would find my fact situation being addressed. I would submit to you that we shouldn't leave it to that wonder. You might say, does the criminal law provide for it under a material witness theory? It must not, or the DAs would not come to the juvenile court seeking this sort of relief. Therefore, what I ask you to do is accept the premise that this kind of child warrants interference in terms of interference with the parent-child relationship upon a showing to a judge that there's reasonable basis to believe that there's an effort being made for this child to recant. If that is the case, then I don't think it should be left to conjecture and to the language I've just talked about. And so what we have sought to do is not expand the jurisdiction of the court, but to expand the section of the law that speaks about what a judge may order given that there is a proceeding already in the juvenile court. So we're talking about a child who has already been referred to the juvenile court for abuse under the theory that these are those who are likely to have the supporting parent who is the weakest. And therefore, we say we add to 419.482, which talks about the things that a judge may do, the language which says that any time after the petition is filed, the judge may change the custody of that child if there is a reasonable showing, as reason to believe is the language, that the child's been subjected to pressure by the custodial parent to withdraw an allegation of abuse. Pretty straightforward stuff.
Allegation of abuse by whom? Abuse by whom?
We are presuming that the allegation of abuse is the basis for which the jurisdictional petition was framed, and that's the intent. Now, if it's vague, it should be the allegation of abuse, which is the basis for the petition which brings the child within the jurisdiction of the court.
But in practical terms, is the problem you are addressing, is the person pressuring the child to recant the same person against whom the allegation of abuse is sent?
No. It is the custodial person, the non-offender, who under the traditional provisions of the juvenile code is not engaged in a course of conduct that would give rise to jurisdiction.
Sure. We got lots of questions here. One more and then I'll spread around. How are you going to prove this?
They do it with enough frequency that district attorneys rely on it in some jurisdictions by going to a judge with an affidavit of an investigating officer to say that this child is exhibiting behavior or making comments that show that the pressure is at work. So they do succeed today in getting orders from judges based on those fact situations.
Further questions? Reverend Cesari.
I am struggling to keep up with all of this, and I think I'm doing okay.
But every time we turn a corner, I just see a floodgate of the potential for abuse of this kind of thing. And it concerns me that each one of these are just really open the door for abusing this and taking, and really the child would become the victim again.
Well, Representative Sunseri, I can understand your dilemma because it's a confusing subject matter. The perversity would be profound if we ended up further abusing children, because what we are trying to do in each of these measures, and specifically here, is to protect a child from further confusion and pressure. And there's already going to be enough. If this individual is the subject of an abuse proceeding, and especially if it's a sexual abuse proceeding, there's a substantial chance that this individual is going to have to testify in juvenile court and in criminal court and so on. So there's a world of pressure on this kid. And what we're seeking to do is minimize it. Now, I can't say it's simple. I wish it were, but it is not, and I don't think it can be.
Well, just a quick follow-up. Believe me that I appreciate the intent, and I am even willing to say error on the side of the children, but I also see the potential here for a lot of other people to be harmed in some of the things that we're hearing about.
Representative Sunseri, we in recognition of that, require a court, and the court's paid by the month to do this, to hear elements presented by one side or both and make orders on the basis of reason to believe. And judges are paid to decide on the basis of evidence. And so this requires somebody to come in with a color, with a showing, with evidence, with something which would give a judge a reason to believe there is cause for concern. And typically that's going to be a police investigation, which, among other things, demonstrates a change in attitude by the child or the expression by the child of someone putting pressure. I don't know how we can get more close to it than that. I cannot say to you that it would be the sort of thing where what you're suggesting couldn't happen, because clearly it could.
Representative Mason, then Representative Parks.
Mr. It's without a doubt, it's probably the worst bill I've ever seen before judiciary. And let me say why. You've got a child that's been abused. That child's probably at home with his mother, and a certain the district attorney is charged, and then that child somehow makes some statements. The child has been traumatized, and basically what you're saying is that if the district attorney decides that the child's story is getting a little weak, get a little inconsistent, the district attorney can go pull it out of the home, pull it away from the mother, put it in a foster home. Thus, not only is the relationship between the child and the abuser destroyed, but you're going to destroy the relationship between mm-hmm. the child and the mother that's at home.
Representative,
and let me finish, Mr. Welch. I mean, I can't really believe that you'd really bring this in here, because the child is in a terrible state as it is. But you know, you're going to say to that child, if you don't keep your story consistent, we're going to pull you out of the home, and you've stepped in the shoes. Not only, you know, there's little enough left of the family, but what your bill would do would be completely destroy the final little part of that family. And by the way, trusting the district attorney, some of whom are very strong advocates, they're going to be trying to win their case. And that's what they're going for. And they will pull the child out if they don't like the way the story is going. And I can't allow that to be done to the child, especially when that's all that's left is it's got its mother. I mean, that's a really wonderful idea to conceive of.
Representative Mason, I doubt my answer is going to satisfy you. However, it's not the district attorney who's going to pull anyone out. It's the judge who's going to write an order. There has to be a process like everything else in the law, and a person who is presumed impartial by reason of their station in life is going to make an assessment of what is presented to them. I can say nothing more about it than that.
Further questions? Representative Bell.
What is the penalty for pressuring a witness when it's not a domestic relations case?
For what? Sorry.
What is the penalty for pressuring a witness when it is not a domestic relations case?
Pressuring a witness.
We're trying to.
Well, or tampering with a witness?
Tampering with a witness or manipulating a witness. I'm hearing...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Edmondson.
It's a C felony, which leads to...
Mr. Welch.
Sounds for a prosecution.
I didn't hear a substantive response Representative Mason's comments. Did the committee consider the point that he just made, or is that... And if so, how did you reconcile it, speaking for the committee?
Representative Edmondson, we considered that issue in a number of contexts. I would say that the issue which we were primarily focusing on was that this victim, throughout the entire process of the task force, the victim is the person who is probably not only abused by the abuser, but by the system. And that what we were trying to fashion in all of the work of the task force was to hear from people about that and then to try to fashion responses to that. Therefore, it is a profoundly difficult decision to remove a child from home. It is equally difficult in this situation as it is with many others. But the testimony we've heard about people who have been unable themselves to cope with their experience without help, coupled with the information we've had by experience from officers who have dealt in families where a traumatized, non-interfering or non-offending parent has either willfully or not willfully further complicated the life of the child, brought us among the many recommendations that are before this committee to one which says we ought to be able to relieve that child who's already in a terrible situation. And we need to make a difficult choice, and that choice is it better to leave the child with this parent who's going to continue to work on the kid, or to remove the child to a situation where that is no longer going to be a pressure? So I would submit to you the committee considered all of that in its decision, among other decisions, to support this measure.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I really don't want to beat this into the ground, but it seems to me the point Representative Mason was making is that in every 100 of these cases, perhaps there is one where the child is not telling the correct story. I mean, now we've got to always, that balance has to be in the equation. Otherwise, we presume everyone to be guilty. So if we presume innocence, then it has to be at least statistically possible that there will be an occasional case where the child's account is not correct. Now, if a prosecutor, I believe, if I'm paraphrasing the representative correctly, that if a prosecutor proceeds with prosecution and then later the parent, the custodial parent, and all, and I'm a custodial parent, I might go to my child and say, did that really happen? Is that true? How could that be? And then the child says, well, maybe it wasn't quite that, or it was somebody else. I mean, you know, that the story begins to change. My concern is, if the prosecutor were to then to say, aha, the story is changing, would that be grounds to remove the child from the home at a time when we've got a very disturbed youngster? And trust me, I fully appreciate the implications of my question, because I, you know, as I speak, I'm debating in my own brain about, you know, where do we err and how do we balance this? It's a very, very difficult balance that we must strike here. And I just want to know if your committee considered the protections for that, albeit unlikely and perhaps incidental situation, but nevertheless possible.
Representative Edmondson, I would answer the question in the affirmative. That was a fair amount of the discussions by the task force members dealt with the question of how many children make false allegations. And that's a disputable issue, by the way. There is a disparity in estimates relative to that. And I can only presume, based on what they do routinely, that for a judge to accept the showing that would be necessary here, it would be in the context of more information than simply what you and I are talking about, where the rest of the investigation has brought us. It would be a broader inquiry than the narrow one that you and I are discussing. I hope that's an answer to your question.
Well, I appreciate the attempt, if not the success.
Representative Bauman.
Yeah, in my experience with juvenile court, judges do look really carefully at the ability of a parent to protect the child from further abuse. And it seems that the real issue here is the one that you kind of assume away in your written testimony, and that is that this would only apply where the child was not in danger of ongoing abuse. But I would think where you had a child in a situation that is so volatile and manipulative that you've got a parent who is pressuring the child to recant testimony about an abuser, that what you've got there is what would presently operate to remove the child under our current scheme, which is a danger of ongoing abuse. And if you don't have a danger of ongoing abuse, I'm not sure I'm tuned into what you do have beyond the danger of the manipulation that the committee is worried about.
Representative Baumann, in the second paragraph of my written testimony, I make reference to that, perhaps not directly. There are judges who would agree with you, and just as clearly there are judges who have opted not to agree with that characterization, assuming the facts. And our effort here was to make a solid frame of reference in which that debate could occur and a decision be made. There would be judges who would say at this juncture that unless you can show me that this child is actually in danger, and I think this might be Representative Mason's point, this is not a basis for the juvenile court to intercede. And there are other judges who would say, well, this is emotional abuse, and therefore there is a basis to exceed, to interfere. And I guess what I'm putting before you is the potential for making a policy statement relative to whether it is or is not.
Mr. Chair, but when, I mean, the reasonable extension of that kind of thought or your logic there is that we will have judges deciding whether a child is in danger of having its testimony pressured away by a parent, and by, you know, and then you've got a situation where if there's any chance of the offending partner getting back with the custodial partner, there is always a danger, so there would have to be removal really in every case. I mean, how can I possibly be looking at, as an individual, at pulling together a family that consists of a potential offender, a potential victim, and a custodial parent, and have that work in the presence of this kind of policy? So, I mean, I think that what we'd be making here is not really a slide toward a policy, but really, you know, maybe we ought to land on the policy statement, which is if abuse has occurred in a family, then the child, you know, has got to be removed from all participants in the family altogether, or this danger indeed exists. I mean, I just don't see us having, I'm not sure that I see that this leaves much territory for exercise of judgment. I think that it kind of dictates a result.
Mr. Welch, if I can follow on that, if Representative Baumann doesn't mind. To make an order providing for the change of custody of the child, the judge, by definition, has to decide that it's in the best interest of the child to be pulled out of the home, all things considered. And I think what's troubling the committee is that we are saying that all other circumstances aside, the belief by a judge that the child is being subject to recant allegations of abuse by definition transcends all other considerations on what is in the best interest of the child and requires that that child be pulled out of the home. And so I guess to fold that into a question, Wouldn't a judge now, on finding that the child has been subject to abuse as defined in Chapter 418, wouldn't the judge be able to come back and revisit that issue and make the same order based on the abuse itself?
Mr. Chairman, let me see if I understand your question. You're asking in today's world,
yes,
if a judge has a case before the juvenile court on the basis of an abuse allegation, and then there is an assertion that the custodial parent is pressuring the child to change the story. Your question is whether the judge could not revisit that on the basis of existing jurisdiction.
Yes.
I can only tell you that some judges appear to be willing to do that and some judges do not. That's why we're before you with this.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parks.
First of all, I guess I want to know, how many more bills do you folks have coming up? Do you know?
How many more bills?
Yeah, you don't.
I can get you that information immediately, but I don't know.
Well, I'm kind of interested in the methodology, and I see the problem you're talking about. Representative Mason talked about is a very, very common problem because advocates really get carried away with their stuff. But what I want to know is what you did in formalizing this, I think you could have accomplished by adding the word emotionally to the section that said physical danger and so forth, and that would have done what the chairman suggested, and that is that would have been one of the considerations. But more importantly, you really lowered the burden of proof substantially when you said a reasonable cause to believe. That isn't even anywhere near a preponderance or beyond a reasonable doubt or clear and convincing or anything else. And it was that intentional, or is that just the way it happened?
Representative Parks, it was intentional. This is not at an adjudicatory level. This is at a preliminary level. When the court is proceeding prior to an adjudication on the facts, and therefore we're working in the context of probable cause, reasonable cause to believe, and that would be the source of this language.
And that would kind of run through the general philosophical makeup with which you approach the whole task force project?
I wouldn't say that because some of the Representative Parks, some of the bills don't deal with pre-adjudicative procedure. The three bills that you've had to deal with this afternoon all are pre-adjudicative and have that language or that context.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix, quickly, please.
Brief comment, then question. Brief comment is, I hope you're not being demoralized by all of this. We're dealing with a lot of technicalities here back and forth. I, for one, support the vast majority of what the task force is trying to do, and I'll do my darndest to make sure it comes through. On the other hand, you have to go through the pain and suffering of dealing with these technicalities because we have to deal with a lot of people out there in the public who are going to beat all over us because they are not as sensitive as they ought to be to those abused children. And I don't want you to bring in a parade of abused children, but I have to say a few years ago, rape victims had to come in front of the legislature to convince the legislature at some point that, the women aren't all out there telling lies and making false accusations. And I sense a tone of people still not wanting to believe little children when they come in to complain of abuse. That's just me venting a little bit. Now, on the bill itself, wouldn't it make it stronger and better and deal with the complaints that we've heard if at line 20, instead of saying if the court has reason to believe, instead put if substantial evidence establishes, then you have an evidentiary standard. And by the way, this is already someone who's in, there's already been an allegation filed, an abuse allegation has been filed, a petition's pending. That's a prerequisite. The court has discretion because we've already said may make an order. But then if we require, if substantial evidence establishes that the child is being subjected to pressure, et cetera, and then add the phrase at the end to deal with other concerns, and the court determines that it is in the best interest of the child to order a change in custody. So the court doesn't have to make a determination it's in the best interest of prosecution or it's in the interest of da-da-da, but that we all understand that all we care about here is the best interest of the child, and that may include and should include a consideration of making sure that these charges are prosecuted or that the petition is prosecuted and so on and so forth. Do you have any problem with that approach?
Representative Mannix, I have no problem with that approach. Based on the discussion we've had today, I would submit that those would be improvements.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Bill.
I think I have a problem with that approach. I ask myself the question, what is best for the child and what is best for the family? Even if that mom is trying her best to convince the kid to drop the charges, I'm not convinced taking the child at that moment is the best thing to do. That mother probably would not, in her right mind, do that unless she had been abused herself and knew other way, or was so emotionally dependent on that spouse who abused, or some of the other dynamics that go into this situation. We know that mom's in trouble. Any mom who would try to convince her daughter to drop the charges is in trouble herself. I think maybe requiring her to go to counseling and keeping that child with her would be more appropriate than taking the child away. And so we talked about the advantages of the juvenile court with services. Maybe the services are what we need to require.
But that's something that can be addressed in every instance, and all we've said is look at the best interest of the child, and maybe the mother being there in the counseling, that would take care of it. I still think that this language would not preclude that. Thank you.
Okay. And we will have a chance to look at both views when we move into work session. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Welch. We appreciate that. You can, as Judge Gillette often says to Representative Edmondson or I or Representative Maddox or others who appear before him, you can get treatment for your whip wounds outside. really are not...
Mr. Chairman, I've never anticipated appearances here as recreational experiences. I'm sorry. Thank you.
All right. Let's move out of public hearing then on House Bill 2409. We're going to move into public hearing on House Bill 2395. It does not look to me like we're going to be able to get to House Bills 2406, 2411, or 2415 today. We do need to get some testimony from a couple of witnesses on 2395, one of whom is not going to be with us for a couple of weeks after today. So move into public hearing on House Bill 2395. Ask Chris Gardner to come up. And counsel, can you refresh our memory for purposes of the committee? Can you refresh our memory on House Bill 2395?
I'd be happy to. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, during the last legislative session, this legislative body passed an exception to the current hearsay statutes, which would allow statements made by children under 10 to be admitted into evidence if certain circumstances were met. There was lengthy onerous procedural safeguards put in statute in order to attempt to make the hearsay exceptions constitutional. The bill is back, or the hearsay provisions are back in front of us at the request of the task force, I think in an effort to make them even more amenable to facilitating child victims in the courtroom. Is that accurate?
Thank you, counsel.
Also, just for the members' information, there was testimony last week regarding some U.S. Supreme Court decisions that could affect Oregon's law. They have been provided to you. There should be in your packet a copy of Idaho versus Wright and a copy of Maryland versus Craig. Interestingly enough, the Supreme Court in Idaho versus Wright came to a similar conclusion that the Oregon Supreme Court did in State versus Campbell, which was that hearsay evidence could not come in under the residual exception, which is what brought the hearsay exception bill to this legislative assembly last session. So in part, we're ahead of the Supreme Court. But there are copies of the residual, which means that if there are other reasons why it ought to come in, it ought to come in.
Well, that's the old, it's hearsay, but it's great hearsay.
Yes, exactly. We should hear it. You know, we really shouldn't let it in, but it's good, so we're going to take it.
The Supreme Court has found against that?
No.
Said that was okay.
Said that was inappropriate in this case.
Oh.
That's what it's really what they say. But that information has been provided to you, and I think that Mr. Gardner has some further suggestions in regards to 2395.
Mr. Gardner, welcome. Thank you for sticking around.
Thank you. I'm going to take a bit of advice from you, Chairman, that I heard you give in the back of the room, which was start at the beginning and explain this, and I think then public advice in short sentences with small words. So I think the first thing that I'd like to address to the committee, and particularly because of a tone that that I've picked up in some comments that I've heard, is just a very brief discussion of what we're talking about when we talk about child abuse and the consequences of it. I heard some skepticism as to a figure of one out of every three females is molested. There have been studies done that date back to 1944, studies done by Alfred Kinsey at Indiana University, who then published a really similar document on the issue of female sexuality. In the course of his studies in the late 1940s and 1950s, he determined that approximately 25% of the adult women he spoke to indicated they had been sexually abused as children. Those studies have been duplicated time and time again. Similar figures are found in every study. One very interesting study was conducted by the Los Angeles Times, and they did a nationwide survey. They confirmed the basic 1 in 4 figure for female victims. And statements did not have sufficient indicia of reliability, primarily because there were expert witnesses who testified that the child could be suffering from parental alienation syndrome and other factors that may or may not have some merit. There were a major battle of the experts in this case. Did not have sufficient indicia of reliability, i.e., it was not so trustworthy that we could conclude that cross-examination would be of marginal utility. And that there was not sufficient corroborative evidence. And it didn't come into the criminal trial. I do not complain of that ruling. Hypothetically, the case is represented to the same judge with the same facts in a juvenile petition. And the judge rules that I'm going to apply exactly the same standard I applied in the criminal case. And this evidence doesn't come in. Now, we have a very different situation when we're talking about a juvenile proceeding. In a criminal case, for the non-lawyers, once again, and I hope this is illuminating to you, Chairman, but in the criminal case,
don't
we begin with the scales of justice entirely tipped to the defendant. That's called the presumption of innocence. And the state has the burden of putting on evidence until the position of the scales are basically reversed. And that's called beyond a reasonable doubt. In a civil case, the standard is preponderance of the evidence, which is also the standard in the juvenile dependency case. That is to say, the scales begin evenly balanced. The issue is, what's the more likely than not explanation in this hypothetical for this child making these statements? Is it that she was abused? Well, she recanted once. Well, that may tip it back. We've got to explain the recantation. Is it that she was coached? Gee, it's pretty hard to explain how a 4-year-old could be coached to answer questions like the situation I described. Once again, we test the different facts. And yet, in this hypothetical, which did occur, we couldn't even get to the question because the evidence wasn't admissible. What I'm suggesting to you is if we have the same standard for admissibility in juvenile dependency cases that we have in criminal cases, we may set a standard for admissibility of the evidence that is here when the burden of proof is here. We may keep evidence out that would be sufficient to prove it's more likely than not the child was sexually abused because we have too high a standard to get it into the courtroom before the trier of fact.
Just a comment, Mr.
Okay, Representative Bauman, and I'm going to take your question. What I'm intending to do is go to a 4:45, and we're going to revisit these issues. And let me just say that I'm as frustrated as the committee is that we weren't able to make quicker headway through here, but I want to congratulate the committee on doing good work, asking hard questions. When we turn work product out on these, it will be good work product, and I think I want us to hold on to that. We will revisit the issues again and again and again until we're satisfied that we've done the work that was brought to us. Representative Bowen.
I bet your voir dire is great, too, by the way. It looks like you've been practicing. Timing, just sort of a timing question. I wondered if your county most frequently in a situation like that would try the criminal case first.
Yes. The dilemma is, I don't believe there's any case law on this, but I would be concerned that if we were to lose the juvenile case, we would be foreclosed on a res judicata or collateral estoppel theory. That's to confuse the non-lawyers. That we'd be foreclosed from going into criminal court, although we would never be foreclosed if we lost the criminal case from going to juvenile court. So we'd always try and do it criminal case then juvenile case.
What about a juvenile court case which signals criminal charges? Do you ever find that you are charging based upon evidence that was elicited in a dependency case?
That happens occasionally, but what we're trying to do now, and I think the whole intent of multidisciplinary team intervention, is that you bring to bear your juvenile court officials, their criminal officials, your CSD, and you develop a coordinated strategy to accomplish whatever your intervention goals are, so that you're not, one system's not reacting to the other, but instead you're kind of getting into the case. Now, I'm not saying that's happening in every case, but that's the goal of what we're trying to do, to prevent that very dilemma.
My concern is there some way to protect the criminal process after you've opened the door in the dependency process?
Well, certainly there's a way, and that is that simply you find that evidence may not be admissible in the criminal case. You might already have a juvenile adjudication that the child's within the court's jurisdiction, and the child is protected at that point. There are no sanctions leveled against the parent unless the parent wants to keep seeing the child. Then the court could level sanctions like, well, you have to get counseling and treatment and has to be supervised.
Sure. But the following case, the case that follows the dependency case,
right,
is...
Right. Even if it's admissible in the dependency case, all those issues still arise if you seek to have the out-of-court statements admitted in the criminal case, and whatever standards appropriate there, which is, I think, already articulated in the statute.
What about the court record from the dependency case?
I don't think it's directly admissible in the criminal case. Now, I may be wrong about that, you could refer that question to your counsel and find out.
I'm just wondering. I'm just trying to make sure that it's actually possible to do one without actually doing the other,
right,
maybe changing some timing decisions.
Right. That's a very sophisticated question to which I don't have an absolute answer right now.
All right. Mr. Gardner, we really appreciate your testimony. I've gotten comments and notes from committee members that you have really helped clarify some things for them. We're going to ask you when you get back from being out of town for your views on some of these other bills as well, because we find
I'd certainly be glad to come back. And if the committee is would like to attempt, I think my effort at drafting solutions to the problems I raised is fairly poor, but I'd be glad to work with counsel in any way possible to bring about some resolution. In addition, there's been some factual issues raised, and if I could provide documentation, I'd be glad to try and do that as well.
We will be on different topics on Friday, committee, and we will return to the task force bills on Monday. So if there's nothing further to come in front of us, we will be done. Thank you for the good work, and we appreciate everyone's input.